So welcome to the second Lightning Talk session. I'm going to briefly explain how this session works for the audience and the speakers. For all the speakers, please sit in one of the front rows so you can get on the stage quickly to deliver your talk. You can do so by talking into the microphone. That's very important so that people can hear you. Do not turn around to see your slides because then you can't, you can't hear me even if I talk. So you can see your slides down on the screen here. Maybe it could be that you are too small, then just move a bit to the side and you can see them. Use the clicker to advance the slides. Stay calm, talk loud and clearly so that everybody can hear your message. Finish on time, which is very important because we have so many talks and we don't want to use more time than we are allowed to. Then get your applause and leave the stage. Yeah, thanks. But I'm not going to leave yet. I'm going to explain for the audience how to listen to Lightning Talks. So it's pretty simple. Just be excellent to each other. Keep in mind all the announcements I just made. But also watch the timekeeper. The timekeeper is right up here, or you can see it on the screen up there, which helps us to track the 5 minutes that every speaker has. Alex, would you take over?
Yes, of course. Good morning, everybody. With the last talk yesterday with Petaloom, we decided to try a more speaker-friendly and more appreciative approach to canceling a talk. You no more 5-4-3-2-1 sounds, we want to laudate them out. So we try to use some applause to stop the talk. This is, I think, more awesome for the speakers and maybe for you as well. For the speakers, as long as the timekeeper is in the green area, you are in the first 4 minutes of your talk. You have plenty of time. When it goes up like this, now you have only about 1 minute left. When it starts turning yellow, you have 1 minute left. These are the last 30 seconds of your talk when they start to get red. So if the red turns up something like this, then you have not much time left. So, and we tried a new approach, 5-4-3-2-1. I think this might work.
Actually. Yeah, I think so too. Because we noticed that most speakers are already on their contact slide, and when we buzz them out, it's not very nice. So we just, send them away with an applause. All right. I think that's it. I'm going to mention the translation. So a very awesome job by the translation team. Please give them a huge round of applause. We will have the German talks translated into English, the English talks translated into German, and also everything translated into French. See the website up there, so https://c3lingo.org for information on how to listen to these translated streams. Yeah, well, then I think we can start. Let's go with the first speaker.
Which is Saturday.
So, good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here so early. I'm here to tell you about a little project that I'm working on Saturday. I'm going to tell you it's a one-day conference that I'm organizing in Berlin next year, which is very soon. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the conference is about, which is the R programming language, a little bit how I ended up organizing a conference, and why I think it's interesting to you, maybe its philosophy, which is open and open source. So let's get started. So R is now one of the main languages for data science and statistical programming. It is a great tool for data visualization as well, and it is free and open source. It's supported by the R Foundation, And it is widely used. It just celebrated its 25th year this year, and is used both in research and in industry. Companies like Google, Airbnb, you can find it just about anywhere. And I'm Noah, I'm from Berlin. And how did I end up dedicating all of my free time, some of my best friends' free time, some of their colleagues, and some of people I just met through Twitter because I announced it a few weeks ago. So it started with Our Ladies. I've been organizing an Our Ladies meetup in Berlin for the past 2 years. And Our Ladies is an effort by, again, the R community to try to promote women's involvement in R code, to get more women to contribute to code and to be active and to feel like R is a language that and a community that is for them. And we do that by offering meetups and mentorship programs. And I've been really, I think it's like my side project, and it's still some of my best work, I think, over the last 2 years. And along that, I also started volunteering. So it looks a little bit like this. I think it's really fun. And if you are interested in R, I highly recommend. It's open for everyone. Only the organizational roles are reserved for women. And around that time, a bit later, I also started volunteering at Forwards, which is a task force by the R Foundation to promote all sorts of diversity and inclusion, not just for women. So it's for LGBTQ+, it's for people with disabilities, it's for different minority groups, and we're really trying to do all sorts of work around that. And this year, I had the opportunity to get for the first time outside of my local bubble. So other than Slack and GitHub, I've only known our users around me and in maybe a few data science conferences. So I went to the European R user meetup in Budapest this year. And they actually, 2 years before that, in 2016, organized the first Saturday event at Budapest. And I was really inspired by their vibrant community and by meeting a lot of people that I only knew through Slack and GitHub thus far, and a lot of sub-communities that are not location-based in the Our Ladies and Our community. And I really thought, well, if you can do this in Budapest, why can't you do it in Berlin? I'm sure we have enough people who use R to create a similar conference. So I thought, why not? Let's organize Saturday, signed up on GitHub, and that's how I ended up doing that. So why did I like so much the idea of it? So it very much relates to my history with Our Ladies and Forwards. It's the philosophy behind Saturday. So it's not let's just have another conference for R, and it's not let's just have another event for people to come and share idea. It's really about let's make sure that as many people as possible can come and share ideas. So how do we do that? We make sure that it's completely volunteer run. We are not for profit, and if we will have any leftover money, we reinvest it into scholarships for the community or events like bringing speakers and so on. It's low cost. We cap it at a minimum wage, and we try to make sure it's both for beginners and for advanced users. And we really make a lot of efforts to include women, minorities, LGBTQ, and people with disabilities. How do we do that? So we don't need to invent the wheel, thankfully. And this might be the interesting part for you. There are a lot of resources about how to make sure that your events and your communities are suitable for as many people as possible. And that you can use DISC, by a NUM focus group. You can use the great resources from other conferences. And I guess that's it. This is our organizing team. If you're interested in more information, and if you want to help us out, then please be in touch.
5, 4, 3. Thank you. Next up is Science Sector, or Public Sector Information Directive.
Yeah, good morning, Leipzig.
Hold on 1 second. So I will talk about the fancy topic public sector information, and in case anybody wonders what that is, that's basically the open data legislative for whole Europe, which is at the moment right now negotiated in the coming weeks in Brussels. And what does that do at a Congress? Well, basically, ideally, from the Hacker Ethics, öffentliche Daten nützen, private schützen, or use public data, protect private data, is like one of the core fundamentals. And I'm working at the Open Knowledge Foundation, so we do a lot of like open data stuff, like Frag den Staat, offene Gesetze, which was recently launched, and Jugendhackt, Code for Germany, OGP, or EIDI. And so what is open data, in case nobody knows it, it's basically data you can freely use, modify, or share by anyone for any purpose, meaning also you can make a business out of it. And this, what you see here, that part is right now negotiated. That's also like open data or data which should be open data held by like public institutions or government-owned enterprises. And that's the list what we are demanding. And to keep it short, basically everything which is funded by public money should be also public good. Or in Germany, there's a campaign by Wikimedia which is called ÖGÖG, öffentliches Gut, öffentliches Geld. The other way around. So that's the standing. In December, there was an ITRE-Ausschuss, the voting, and right now the negotiation. And why this is important? Because also like in Germany, in this legislative period, we should get a new open data law. At least that's like in the coalition contract. And I want to illustrate that why that is important. One example, and that is like public transportation data, which is like right now a really bad, sad affair in Germany. And why is that important? Because, for example, we want to have increased mobility, less CO2, and it's a big sector. So that's the current state. Where it's green, we have open data in the transportation sector. Here we are in Leipzig, and everything else is like not compatible with 2018, I would say. And when you're missing data, you get like some weird routing issue shit, like what you can see here. And that goes around all over Europe. So by the end of the day, or like in the long run, we first have a human being on the Mars before we have like public open data in the transportation sector. And we want to change that. And there's actually hope. So when we use open standards, open software, open data, there's a great example coming from Finland, which they created this platform just for Helsinki, but it was open. So it was modifiable for anybody else. So there's like Meran, which is a tiny town in Italy, adapted that model like for just 15,000 euros. And you have like a live map where the buses are going. And that was done by one developer because Helsinki was so awesome providing the platform as open source, and there was data standards. So what that means, basically, you can move from like data shoveling by your hand to like industrial rollout. And that means like efficiency. It's like just awesome when you think about what could be done across Europe when we have standards. And that's the directive should be there for it. And it's not just like this case, transportation. It's also like for transparency when it comes to beneficial ownership of companies, or for example, what public broadcasting stations are doing, that you can see the content and use it later. So that's a detailed list. I don't know how much time we have. Basically, what you should think about it, how awesome it would be if we deal like public data as an infrastructure and what can be done with it. And so please bug your local politicians or whoever is in charge of it on local level. And if you're interested, contact us. The slides are online. They're linked because it's, I think, a little bit timely. And I think that was from my side. So we still have time for a Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions right now?
Yeah.
I don't see any hands. But we're always happy if we are a bit short on time because, yeah.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. Next up is password strength meters.
Okay. Good morning. We are here to talk about passwords, and it's 2018, and we can say that passwords are here to stay, and we're going to see them for a long time now. And we also can admit that passwords actually can be quite good, considering it's like a knowledge-based single-factor authentication mechanism. But passwords are only quite good if we select suitable passwords. And that brings us to the topic on how do we actually measure the strength of passwords. This is a big topic. It's called password strength meters. There are a lot of them out there, actually. There has been some progress in the hacking community, in the academic community. But there's still a lot of debate of what strength meter is actually good and what is to be considered good. I have two examples at the bottom. On the left-hand side, you can see GitHub. And this is a password strength meter that starts out with like a policy that is displayed in red. And as you start typing, this policy is kind of validated. And if you match the policy, it's made green. On the right-hand side, we can see GMX. I tried to create an account yesterday for emails. And I started typing a password, like one of the simplest ones I could make up, like 128, the digits, and actually the meter made it quite green, which is surprising that this is considered to be a strong password by GMX in 2018. Now, we are trying to improve on that. So we are proposing a new password strength meter. We are planning to open source it like earlier next year. And it's a fuzzy logic-based approach that combines multiple indicators for a password strength. So we can have like policy stuff in there, like length and so on. But we can also have like lists of leaked passwords. We can have Levenstein distance and further combinations. It's supposed to be really lightweight so that it can be integrated in every browser and every website. But it's only an approach, and we have to make sure that it is really good. And this is where my colleague Nikanta is going to ask for your help.
Hi. So basically, there are a lot of things you can use in a password strength meter. But when we thought about ways to evaluate one, we said, oh, we have a problem. You see, in science, a way to evaluate a hypothesis is to do an experiment. And that's why we need you. So we are launching the Password Hacker Contest with a goal of evaluating password strength by trying to break it. And we want to crowdsource your knowledge to help build new, better strength meters. What we did is we collected a list of human-generated passwords from people we trust, like our mothers, etc. So no unfair competition there. And this contains a mix of weaker and stronger passwords. We hashed them with a SHA-512 and with a common salt to reduce the overhead of expensive machinery for more hashing. And what we want from you is to work in teams or alone, use your favorite tools, do whatever you like, and try to break them. What we want at the end is the plain text, which is the proof that the passwords were broken, and a short report saying how you did it and which passwords were easier to break and which were more difficult to break. Of course, we offer some amazing prizes, like Amazon gift cards, a lot of surprise swag, like t-shirts, polo shirts, and so on. A ThinkPad W500, which is the old IBM design, so you can also use it as a brick. Nerf guns, and basically you can come at our office and take a lot of stuff that we don't need anymore. We ship freely in a whole of Germany, but we really like to see you at our office in Darmstadt. So what you can do now is go in on this address, and there are instructions there. There's the first batch of hashes, and you can start hacking. Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up would be Netlink and Go.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. Today, I want to talk to you about Netlink and Go. My name is Florian, and I'm very interested in network stuff. And if you take a look at the web servers around the world, this is the kind of code you will see nowadays. It's basically, in this kind of example, Go web server. This is just showing you a simple website. And there's always one big question if you're in a reliable service. How many numbers of sessions do we have? How long are the durations of the sessions? And what about the number of amount of traffic that is transferred for your on your web service? There are a couple solutions you can use, and you can blow up the code completely and make it really hard to understand if you want to make sure that the next person you hire can also understand the business logic of your web server. Keep it simple and try to move the monitoring part away. And there's one solution I can offer you. We at the moment, we have the web server in the user space and the Unix kernel in the kernel space. And the kernel itself has some kind of tracking of sessions. And why don't you use this kind of API so you can use this for monitoring? There's the so-called Netlink family. The Netlink family is a socket-based interface for user space processes to communicate with the internal kernel API. and you can get various information about different kind of stuff. In total, at the moment, there are 21 different subgroups you can use for that are based on a Netlink protocol. For example, there's Netlink Route, Netlink Crypto, where you can change crypto settings, internal crypto settings of your computer. There's also Netlink XFRM for IPsec stuff, SE Linux, and a lot of stuff. As I'm most interested in networking, I concentrate on Netlink and Netfilter, and there are divided into three parts, basically, NFLog, NFQ, and Contract. Maybe if you worked with IP tables, you heard of them. And in Go, you can now basically use this binary-based protocol to directly communicate with the kernel, get information out there, get the number of sessions, how long they take, how long they last, and just use this information that's already there and don't have to blow up your own code. And it's completely in a separate way, so you don't have to blow up your web server, and it can be done in a quite easy way. The byte stream that you get from the kernel via the socket is basically only a byte stream. In difference to most byte streams, the combination is the length, type, and value, not the type, value, type, length, and value. So this is a little bit different to most protocols you maybe know. And but it's basically all the same. So you just have to take a look at the length, check the type, and then you have the value. Value can be anything. Can be from byte sequences to strings, numbers, integers, timestamps, everything what the kernel you can provide. And for conversation, Golang has a lot of features, so you don't have to make sure. So for example, if you want to monitor your web application, this is a quite simple example. With IP tables, you send everything through NFLog group 100, then you open the socket with NFLog open. In this example, I set a timeout for 30 seconds just to make sure that this will stop at 30 seconds, otherwise it will run forever, and then you can get all the NFLog messages. So you have a quite good overview of what is happening on your web server, and you don't have to change your web server application. This also works for different kind of models. If you, for example, provide your web server in Java, if you do something like this, or PHP. So thank you for your attention. The most reliable information is the man page, number 7, Netlink. You can try the GitHub repo or check out the Linux kernel source. If there are any questions, I'm around. Just ping me. I'm Florian, and I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is the food hacking base.
Again? Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is František Algor Aftelbeck, and I would like to present the food hacking base project. This year, it's our, I think, 7th Congress when we are around. We have been starting with 27C3. It was very interesting for us to get involved and during the years basically build up the community around the food, beer, and drinks. I have to say that the last Congress, 34C3, when we actually were inside, compared to 33C3, when we could see us on a roof of the Hall H, was much better. It was warmer. We had a warm water. We have a big place where you could come and do stuff. I don't know how many of you have been actually visiting Food Hacking Base during the years. Can I just ask for the hands up who has popped in? Also, it's starting to get in. We have been happy with the place. Tight at the end of the Congress, I have to say, when people finally found us. But this year it got better. We'll go to that. Small overview of the year which we are just now finishing. We have visited in the spring New Ligand. This is the poster for the next year. We have found out as a project that actually when we are invited and we get help, you know, kind of, you know, promoting project from the local host, it really kind of make it possible to kind of cover the expenses of the event for us. We are a donation-based group, so kind of, you know, what we put in, we put in. If you support us, good. If you don't, well, we have to basically cover it by ourselves. We have been at FrightCat in Belgium, which was a fairly run event where we didn't do actually crowdsourcing for a bigger kind of camp like that for us, which we have found out it's difficult after to cover. So experience, another one. I don't know how many of you have been at the EMF. It was my first one basically in Great Britain. It was very nice. We did a kitchen-free environment because getting our stuff from Europe to the UK was a bit complicated considering transportation, but it worked quite fine, so it's good. Now this year we did the 35C3, that's where I am. You can find us in the hall 2, between the door 2.6 and 2.7. As you can see, this is already our first evening tasting and we are completely full. So we have been actually really nicely surprised with the amount of people who are showing up and also with the dynamic of the group, because I have to say, it's really maybe like, you know, one of the first events when we as a core group don't have to do so much and people are actually doing the stuff. They just come and use the place, which is nice, and we just more or less you know, keep an eye that, you know, things are magically appearing from the shops, you know, which, you know, has to be used. So this is very nice. Now, we'll be finishing the Congress. I hope all goes well. We hope to be a bit in a plus, you know, so we can actually fund our project for the next year, which are again, you know, community kind of based, you know, and open. We would like to be at the camp, of course, that will be coordinated with the Orga, where we again, we will do our tasting events, workshop events, you know, kombucha making, beef jerky making, incubators, etc. We would like to do fermentation project, fermentation mobile, which I already presented before, which is basically, you can imagine a food truck, but play, you know, thing which is legalized and can go to the different events where we can really kind of, you know, do workshops and stuff on a kind of, I would say, higher protected level. So that is a project which I would like to lead and with support of the Fuedkin base. Otherwise, I believe we are open to invitations. So if you talk to us, just send us email, foodhacking.org, you know, just you write foodhacking base, you will find us. And you'll get a response eventually, sooner or later. And we are interested to come to different happenings. We have been in MRMCD, we have been at the Balkon, we have been in the Newsline. So different events, we enjoy it. It's something what we like to do and promote. And we hope that more people get involved and support these activities also in their local hackerspaces. Because during the years, I have to say, and it's my experience, it's my feel, that taking care about yourself from the point of view of food, drinks, a bit of exercise, it really helps, especially for most of you who are sitting most of the day behind the desk. Try to keep a bit healthy in the side. It really makes your life more easy. I would like to thank all of you for listening to what I have to say. Please come and visit us at the Fuedkin base, and that's all. Thank you again. Bye.
Thank you. Next up is Geta Viz. Did I pronounce that correctly? Get a vice, get a view. I don't know. We'll see.
Hello, I'm here to present GetAviz, which is a research project and open source project for solving software engineering problems in three simple steps. And these steps I'm going to present to you. So first step is, we collect a lot of data about your software project. This can be a lot of things. We use JQ Assistant for that. It provides a Neo4j graph database and with a lot of plugins where you can combine and link different data sources. Currently, we support 5 different programming languages, 2 version control systems, and many other data sources like GitHub issues, Maven build reports, JUnit test reports. And then at the result, we have a huge database with a lot of information about the software project. And then this is the data source for finding the solution to your problem. And to help this, we visualize the data. There are a lot of visualizations available. There are classical dashboards with tree maps, bar charts, and all this classical stuff, and more fancy visualizations on the right side. And here, for example, you can see analysis for anti-pattern. This is Antler. We find a lot of cyclic dependencies there, for example. And yeah, these visualizations are supposed to help you to understand your problem, which is the last step. Because, as you know, understanding the problem is almost the same as having the solution. Once you understood the problem, the rest is rather easy. And for this, we provide a complex user interface for exploring and analyzing the visualized data and get a better understanding of the software project in general. That's the point where I usually would give you a live demo, which is not possible here, so you have to do it yourself. That's the official project URL, or just go to bit.ly/getawith. There you find some showcases and online demos you can use in the browser. Yeah, and that are the three steps. Give it a try if you are working with software in some way. But there's a fourth step. You can contribute to it. Currently, it's a small project with academic background, but we hope to build an open source community around it. So you can contribute to any programming language because we are going to extend it to support more data sources with JQ Assistant or more visualizations and a better user interface for Getawith. And as in 2018, we are going to apply for Google Summer of Code next year, so in a month or so. So if you are a student, there's a chance you can even get paid for this. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Zik Rock.
Okay, hello everyone. My name is Sören, and I would like to introduce you to our SigRock project. As you can see on the table here, we try to support all kinds of devices, especially everything kinds of test and measurement related. You can see like multimeters, oscilloscope, logic analyzers, all kinds of stuff. We currently support over 200 devices, and the question is, how do we do that? If you look at the software stack of our project, you can see that the core component is libsigrock. It is a library that encapsulates all the drivers for all the devices we support and provides a unified API for all of them. So you can access them having only one API to deal with and getting all the data from them. Below that, you see libusb, libserial port, libftdi1, and libgpib, libglib. And these are the libraries that we need to actually access the hardware below. On top, you have a libsigrock client. That is the software actually tries to communicate with the devices and display the data or process it in some way. We'll see in this in a minute what actually is going on there. But next to it, you see the libsigrock decode library. It's a library that is kind of on the side of libsigrock. It's providing protocol decoders, which I will also talk about in a minute. It's using Python and libglib. The first client I would like to talk about is the obligatory command line interface. It's usable for acquiring data, converting data, decoding data. Essentially, it's a very scriptable tool, so you can do some kind of test automation or whatever you like to do with it. Another client we have is SigRock Meter. It is tailored for use of multimeters, so you can have all kinds of multimeters and measure the data, data log it, whatever you want to do with it. It is quite feature-rich already, but currently needs a maintainer. So if you feel interested, please come to us and talk to us. Another client that is a relatively recent addition is SMUView. It's a program that tries to emulate a source measurement unit using a power supply and an electronic load. I haven't used it personally, but I have heard it's quite good, so please give it a try. A very even more recent addition is the Sigrok mini server. It allows you to access all your devices supported through Sigrok using a JSON interface. For example, here you can see Node-RED and interface to provide access to a power supply and electronic load. Finally, we have PulseView, which is our most feature-rich and also the most popular client that we have. It is available, for example, for Linux, Windows, OS X, and Android, actually. So it's quite flexible in what we do with it. And here you can see some standard setup. You have two signals, SCL, SCA, that have been acquired through some logic analyzer. And we have added a protocol decoder for I2C to actually visualize the data in some kind of meaningful way. Okay, now this is pretty standard. You can do that with any oscilloscope, really, I understand that. But what we do is actually we go one step further and actually allow you to have protocol decoders written in Python that you can use to make even more sense of the data that you have. In this example, we have attached a DS1307 real-time clock, so you can actually see what the data means to the chip and what the data means to other chips that comes in and out of a chip that is on the bus. So this is pretty cool because essentially it allows you to have any oscilloscope that you have on your bench, if you have a driver for it, or any logic analyzer that you have, to have all kinds of protocols that it doesn't usually support. And we can have a driver for it and provide you with all the protocol decoders that you already have. Also, what I would like to point out is that there is a Cypress FX2 development board available for less than $10 or 10 euro here in Europe, which you can use in combination with Sigrok to actually have a 10 euro logic analyzer, which is quite feature rich. And since we have currently over 100 protocols available, you suddenly have all kinds of utilities available on your workbench for only 10 euros. So that's quite popular, and also the reason why the Sigrok project is very popular in these kind of circles. I would like to give you some examples of what exactly we have also. It's ARM-ETM as a decoder. Oh, I have to speed up, okay. Which you can use to trace and have code. This is USB. Also with PCAP output, and what I want to take away is that we try to be a unicorn. We do have lots of decoders, and we can give you lots of opportunities. If you want to contact us, come to our assembly, or come to Twitter, Mastodon, or just chat with us on IRC. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So then next up is Datenkrake gefunden und nun, it's going to be a German talk, so you might want to check out the translation page on c3lingo.org for translated streams.
Ja, guten Morgen. Mein Englisch wollt ihr nicht hören, deswegen mache ich es lieber auf Deutsch. Mein Name ist Alba Freude, ich bin Mitarbeiter und Referent beim Landesbeauftragten für Datenschutz Baden-Württemberg und ich erzähle euch ein bisschen was zum Thema Datenschutz. Ja, der eine oder andere wird vielleicht hin und wieder mal über bei der Analyse irgendeiner Software, einer Hardware, einer Webseite oder was auch immer darauf gestoßen sein, dass dort seltsame Datenübertragungen drin sind, die man vielleicht nicht haben will, aus Privatsphärengründen oder Ähnlichen. Da kann man sich natürlich die Frage stellen, ist das denn überhaupt erlaubt? Nun, nein, häufig ist es nicht erlaubt, denn kurz gesagt, Daten ohne gewichtigen Grund oder der Einwilligung des Nutzers zu sammeln, ist häufig nach der Datenschutzgrundverordnung der DSGVO unzulässig. Viele haben vielleicht gehört, die Geschichten mit Klingelschildern und ähnlichen Späßen, die irgendwie durch die Medien gehen, das ist alles Unfug. Aber es gibt viele Sachen, wo ihr auch was tun könnt. Nämlich, ihr könnt euch anschauen, welche Software, welche Hardware, welche seltsamen Datenübertragungen habt und gucken, was da nicht in Ordnung ist. Zum Beispiel haben wir eine Pflicht zur Datensicherheit. In Artikel 32 steht zum Beispiel die Verschlüsselung explizit drin. Also häufig ist dann tatsächlich so, dass wir auch Verschlüsselungen verlangen als Aufsichtsbehörde. Und wir haben die Pflicht zu Privacy by Design und Privacy by Default. Die ergeben sich aus Artikel 25 der Datenschutzgrundverordnung. Beispiele für solche Verstöße sind, wir haben in Baden-Württemberg das erste Bußgeld in Deutschland an eine Firma vergeben, vor ein paar Wochen. Es ging darum, dass dort ein Unternehmen, seine User eines Webdienstes, die Daten im Klartext gespeichert hat, und zwar die Passwörter. Brauche ich euch nicht erzählen, warum das böse ist. Die haben ein relativ kleines Bußgeld bekommen, weil sie sehr kooperativ waren und auch ein relativ kleines Unternehmen. Bei größeren Unternehmen kann das dann relativ teuer werden. Insgesamt können bei der DSGVO Verstöße 20 Millionen kosten oder 4% des weltweiten Jahresumsatzes. Unverschlüsselte Datenträger oder USB-Sticks verschicken oder auf Notebooks durch die Gegend tragen, wäre auch so etwas, was man ahnden könnte. Oder je nach Kontext muss man sich es genauer anschauen, aber wer regelmäßig medizinische Daten per E-Mail verschickt, würde auch Probleme kriegen. Tracking ohne Einwilligung oder Weitergabe von Nutzerdaten an Dritte wie Facebook Custom Audiences ist auch nach herrschender Meinung rechtswidrig. Die bayerischen Kollegen haben da auch schon Urteile vor Gericht durchgefochten. Ja, was kann man tun? Ihr könnt natürlich irgendwie eure Geräte abdichten, sodass keine Daten rausfließen. Das hilft aber nur euch und das hilft nicht den Leuten, die sich damit nicht so toll auskennen. Ihr könnt aber auch Beschwerde bei der jeweiligen Aufsichtsbehörde einreichen. Bei der Aufsichtsbehörde, die für den Hersteller zuständig ist oder für den Vertrieb oder den sonstigen Verantwortlichen, wie man ihn nennt, der die Daten sammelt, oder die Aufsichtsbehörde an eurem Wohnort. Sucht einfach entsprechend mit der Suchmaschine eures geringsten Misstrauens nach Datenschutz, Aufsichtsbehörde, Bundesland, und dann findet ihr das. Wie gesagt, hohe Bußgelder kann das ergeben und die Behörde muss dann auch tätig werden. Also wenn wir Sachen selber irgendwie recherchieren, dann können wir tätig werden, dann müssen wir das nicht zwangsweise machen. Aber wenn ihr eine Eingabe macht, müssen wir tätig werden. Das kann aber auch sein, dass wir aus Baden-Württemberg das dann an Berlin, Hamburg oder Schleswig-Holstein abgeben, wenn dort der Verantwortliche sitzt. Wichtig ist für solche Sachen sachlich schildern, was denn was ihr gefunden habt, möglichst viele Details nennen. In den Aufsichtsbehörden sitzen in der Zwischenzeit nahezu überall gute Techniker, die das auch verstehen, also sind nicht nur Juristen. Die Technikteams sind meistens relativ klein. Wir sind 5 Leute in Stuttgart, in Baden-Württemberg, aber trotzdem sind da Leute, die verstehen, was ihr da einschickt. Also auch einen TCP-Dump oder sonst was ist jetzt irgendwie den Leuten ein Begriff. Sachlich schildern, möglichst viele Details nennen. Ihr könnt das auch anonym machen. Ja, also wenn ihr zum Beispiel nicht nur eine Drittsoftware analysiert, sondern bei einem Unternehmen arbeitet, wo ihr sagt, das geht mal überhaupt nicht, was hier passiert und meine Chefs hören nicht auf mich, dass das nicht legal ist und ihr wollt das nicht weiter mittragen, könnt ihr auch anonym als Whistleblower zu den Aufsichtsbehörden kommen und entsprechend eine Eingabe machen. Kleiner Tipp, möglichst irgendeine Kontaktmöglichkeit hinterlassen, weil häufig haben wir dann doch Rückfragen, weil nicht immer alles 100% klar ist aus den Beschwerden oder Eingaben. Ja, das mal so als großen Rundumschlag. Heute Abend gibt es noch eine Self-Organized Session im Raum M3 zwischen 18.30 Uhr und 20 Uhr. Da sind mehrere Leute, die was zum Thema Datenschutz erzählen in so 15-Minuten-Blöcken. Da werde ich auch sein. Ich habe das angemeldet und da schauen wir mal, ob da noch, wenn irgendwelche Fragen sind oder wenn jemand irgendwelche besonderen Probleme, Wünsche oder Ähnliches hat. 18.30 Uhr Raum M3 heute Abend. Tschüss.
Thank you. Danke. And we have one of the usual suspects. Org Backup.
So, hi, I just wanted to give a short update about Borg Backup, and on the first few slides I have some overview for the people who don't know it yet. My name is Thomas, and let's see. So quick, the features of Borg Backup, it's a backup tool, and you usually use it on the command line, so it has a CLI interface like rsync or like Git or whatever. But recently, there were also some people working on the GUI. So if you have non-nerdy friends that rather click around, then you can also use it now. We have quite good architecture and platform and file system support, and the main features are we are doing deduplication, we are doing compression, authenticated encryption, and the usual way you use it, you read the data from a locally mounted file system, and then you store it to another local file system, or you can also store it to a remote server over SSH, and the one Borg will talk to another Borg on the remote side. A nice feature is you can fuse mount your repositories, your backup archives. And okay, if you do not have a remote server, it's no big problem. There are some service providers, meanwhile, that offer such services, like, for example, rsync.net or Hetzner. And a new one is borgbase.com. It has a quite nice web interface. And the Borgbase guy is also programming this nice GUI client. Also, if you don't want to rent a server, you can just search for another nerd, and you can do mutual backups. They are encrypted, so you don't have a big trust issue, because the other guy won't be able to look into your backup. Another way to use it, if you rather prefer to have something in the cloud, maybe additionally to your local repository, you can first create a local repository and then push this complete repository to the cloud, for example, using rclone. And of course, if you have your own server, you can just use SSH. The GUI tool I mentioned is called Volta, and it's implemented in Python and Qt. Currently, it's tested on Linux and on macOS, but it might be even possible in the future maybe to adapt it to Windows. And as I said, you can show it to your friends. Another tool is Borgmatic. It's basically a configuration layer on top of Borg. So if you prefer a config file like ini style, you can use this tool. And there are lots of other tools and scripts and integrations, and we have a special community repository. And if you search additional tools, you can just look there. In general, it's a community project. So if you are coding in Python or C or Cython, join us, please. Currently, we are a bit low on developers. But you can also help if you can't code, for example, look after the docs, or just test it. We have a good test suite, and using continuous integration, and for platform testing, we use Vagrant. Also, we need supporters for different platforms, so if you, for example, use NetBSD or something, also come to us. The current status is there is an old stable release out since quite long. I think you can find it in about every distribution. And the current release is 1.1. So this is the newest stuff. And the next release, maybe 2019, will mostly have code cleanups, refactorings, and some internal stuff, and also new repository compaction handling. It will be separate, not automatic like now. And for the bigger changes on the bottom, for the Helium milestone, we need more people, because the crypto changes will be a lot of work, and also the multi-threading changes are a lot of work. We also need community supporters. So for example, if you can help people because you use Borg yourself, you can also help and look after GitHub and the mailing list. A security review would be also good. We have some known issues, but also somebody could look over the code. And we also need more sponsors and donations, because we do bounties using Bounty Source. So I'm here at the Congress. Find me at a Python assembly. And yeah, I think we are out of time. So you can click on the screencasts using that link. OK, thank you.
Thank you. So just a quick reminder, all the slides that the speakers uploaded into our system, you can download them. Just visit c3lt.de, also c3lt.de, and there you can download the slides, visit the schedule, and so on. All right, next up is TUM exam. Oh, that was the browser. Let me just move that. That's why I prefer PDFs. So if you want to give a talk here, you do best with PDF. It's portable. It's a document format. Okay, let's go.
Also zuerst mal, es ist ein PDF, ne? Okay, also mein Name ist Stefan Günther, ich bin von der Technischen Universität München und ich will heute ganz kurz darüber sprechen, wie wir am Lehrstuhl mit sehr großen schriftlichen Prüfungen fertig werden. Dazu schauen wir uns mal unsere Grundlagenvorlesung an. Das ist eine Pflichtveranstaltung für alle Informatik-Bachelor-Studenten an der TUM. 2015 hatten wir 1.152 Klausurvorlagen. Das ist in den letzten drei Jahren auf knapp 1.700 gestiegen, einfach weil wir mehr Studierende haben. 2015 waren es noch 36 Teilaufgaben zu korrigieren. Dieses Jahr waren es fast 74.000. Liegt neben der gestiegenen Anzahl an Studierenden daran, dass wir jetzt kürzere Aufgaben stellen, die halt einfach leichter zu korrigieren sind. Da wir eine Erst- und Zweitkorrektur haben, waren das dieses Jahr 150.000 Einzelbewertungen, die wir irgendwie haben durchführen müssen. Nur die Anzahl an Papierseiten ist ein bisschen zurückgegangen auf 23.000 Seiten Papier. Das lag daran, dass wir einfach ein kürzeres oder kompakteres Template mittlerweile nutzen. Dafür haben wir dieses Jahr noch zusätzlich 2.500 Quizze, Multiple-Choice-Quizze gehabt, was weitere 32 Teilaufgaben sind und weitere 5.000 Papierseiten waren. So, wie werden wir damit fertig, ohne verrückt zu werden? Naja, wir arbeiten seit 2015 schon an einem eigenen Scanner-Klausurensystem namens TUMXM. Wir versehen die Angaben mit QR-Codes, individuellen QR-Codes. Wir können so pseudonymisiert korrigieren, weil wir keine Namen auf den Klausuren mehr draufstehen haben. Wir scannen die Klausuren danach ein und erfassen die Bewertungen digital und stellen den Studierenden dann die Klausuren online zur Einsicht zur Verfügung. Wen das interessiert, wie das ganz genau funktioniert, der kann sich unseren Lightning Talk von 2015 angucken, da erklären wir das. Jetzt will ich noch ganz kurz darauf eingehen, was sich seitdem getan hat. Bis zu dem Zeitpunkt hier Ende 2015 haben wir TUMXM nur am eigenen Lehrstuhl eingesetzt. Das hat sich dann geändert, zunächst an befreundeten Lehrstühlen. Wir haben von QR-Codes auf Data-Metrics-Codes gewechselt, einfach weil die robuster und flexibler sind. Wir haben unser Klausur-Template nochmal komplett neu implementiert in LaTeX. Wir haben die Datenbank neu implementiert, jetzt in Postgres. Wir haben uns einen sündhaft teuren Dokumentenscanner gekauft. Dokumentenscanner wären eigentlich einen eigenen Lightning-Talk wert. Die Mechanik ist normalerweise ganz toll bei den Geräten, aber die Software ist totale Katastrophe. Seit dem Zeitpunkt haben wir auch eine eigene Plattform für die Online-Einsichten. Seit Ende 2016 entwickeln wir ein Webinterface zur Klausurverwaltung samt Touch- und Stifteingabe. Wir haben Anfang 2017 das sogenannte Karpfinger-Klausurkonzept integriert, wenn das interessiert. Es ist am Ende von den Folien verlinkt. Es ist ein Konzept für besonders kompakte Mathematikprüfungen. Wir unterstützen neuerdings Quizze und Multiple-Choice-Prüfungen. Wir haben zwischen Mai und Oktober 2017 über 7,5 Klausuren und Quizze in ein bisschen mehr als 20 Veranstaltungen mit dem System abgewickelt. Wir haben uns im Zuge dessen dann auch einen richtigen VM-Server besorgt. Seit Ende 2017 beschäftigen wir uns auch mit der Integration von volldigitalen Prüfungen in TUMXM. Wir haben uns eben wegen der Problematik mit den Scannern ein eigenes Scanner-Frontend implementiert. Unser Webinterface ist jetzt seit Anfang des Jahres endlich nutzbar geworden. In der studentischen Arbeit haben wir eine automatische Synchronisation mit der Einsichtsplattform implementiert. Auch eine studentische Arbeit beschäftigt sich gerade mit einer iPad-App zur volldigitalen Korrektur von Prüfungen. Wir unterstützen neuerdings auch fremde Klausurvorlagen, die eben nicht unser LaTeX-Template verwenden. Und ja, heute war mal wieder ein Lightning Talk. Wen das Thema interessiert, kann am StuStudent Assembly vorbeikommen. Wir haben ein bisschen Anschauungsmaterial dabei. Können wir uns einfach mal ein bisschen austauschen. Und wen es wirklich interessiert, vielleicht kann es auch mal jemand von euch nutzen. Danke.
Danke. Next up is Irma. I'll reveal my attributes.
There's a, if you click the left image.
Oh, I'm already supposed to click the link. Okay, let's see what happens. You have been owned. No. Ah, okay. That's a PDF, right?
Yeah, it's a PDF. You can also just
okay. Maybe I can put it here on full screen. Oh, okay.
Does work? Yeah, does work. Okay. I want to introduce Irma to you. It's an open source project in which you can privacy friendly, secure, and decentrally provide authentication and signing. So for the user, the most central thing is the app that you see on the left side is on iOS and Android. And the project is intended to authenticate and sign statements about yourself with attributes you collect on your own mobile phone. So for example, you see a login to Irmatube, our demo application, but there is also in the Netherlands a few attributes from governments which you can collect, and you can then later prove those that information to others in a way that they can be sure that the information is correct, but also that those people don't learn anything about your interactions online. That's a key difference between how authentication is done nowadays. For example, when you click a login with Google or a login with Facebook link at this moment, you have a user identity provider and you want to log in on a web store, for example. At the moment, you first go to the web store that has a page that says, I want to log in with Google. So you go to your the identity provider to Google, and then the identity provider reveals the login information to the web store. So Google now knows what you're doing. That probably isn't, maybe isn't the problem if you want to order something, but if you want to log in your doctor's office, for example, you don't want all those companies collecting that information. So what we want to provide as a different solution is that you collect all the statements that allow you to log in somewhere on your mobile phone. So you first go to an identity provider, you collect those statements, and then you reveal them to the web store without communicating with the identity provider anymore. And you can do that again and again, and you don't need to contact that identity provider again to do another login or do another authentication. So the security guarantees we have is that the attributes, the information in the app, that it is authentic, it's signed with a digital signature. You can prove ownership. There's you need to prove knowledge of the Irma PIN, so you need to fill in a PIN code to say you have knowledge of that. There's a secret key stored on your mobile phone that also says that you own those attributes. So you have a two-factor authentication. The disclosures you do are also in another way unlinkable. We use credentials, an attribute-based credential scheme called EDMIX. Which if you do two disclosures, it makes it unlinkable, so it's a multi-show unlinkable credential scheme. And that makes that if you, as long as you have attributes that don't reveal anything about yourself, for example, if there's an attribute that says I'm over 18 or I'm a German citizen, for example, if you reveal those attributes to someone, they can't see that you're the same person two times. So the attributes are not linkable as long as the attributes themselves are not identifiable. And there's this kind of automatic data minimization because you only reveal the attributes that you really need to, that the one who's who you're proving them to really needs to see. So you only show relevant attributes. You need to give your consent if you want to hand them to. So a typical session goes, you go to the website of the web store here, you scan a QR code or you click on a link, the Irma app then opens. It asks you, hey, this web store wants to know this and this information of you. You then either consent or you don't. And then go ahead, prove those attributes without involving anyone except you and the one on the other side, the web store in this case. We also do signatures, so there's also, since the 90s, it's always been a problem to give people access to proper signatures. You have to create a public key infrastructure and people have to collect their own signature and have to manage their private keys. We also, with this, have attribute-based signatures, so you collect those attributes, for example, your government number, it's BSN in Dutch. And you can sign any message you want. So, for example, here I consent to share data with my doctor. You can sign that sign that statement with an attribute, and then can prove that you have retrieved that attribute from the government in this case. So, in the Netherlands, we do this with DigiD. You log in with DigiD, and then you collect your information. Anyone can do this. It's a decentral system. There's some more information about this. We're an open source project. You can see us on our GitHub. The core is written in Go. We're transitioning for the server part to Go as well. It's a Java server at this moment. You can see some more information if you want to join Slack, in which we communicate about this. You can ask for an invite, and well, you can download the app. Please do so. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, last talk before the break. It's going to be in German, auf Deutsch. Warum wir 2 Jahre lang Wikibooks ausgedruckt haben.
Ja, hallo. Wir wollten schon immer mal Teile des Internets ausdrucken und haben das dann mal mit einer Plattform von Wikibooks probiert. Und als Ergebnis halten wir hier das wohl schönste in Druckform vorliegende Wikibooks derzeit in Händen. Das Wikibook, was wir gewählt haben, ist Mathe für Nicht-Freaks. Kennt das zufällig jemand? Okay, doch ein paar. Freut mich. Hier sehen wir jetzt schon ein bisschen überarbeitetes Design von unserem Designer. Das Ziel ist einfach, dass man Studenten die Hochschulmathematik verständlich rüberbringt. Und dazu verwenden wir eingebettete Medien, Bilder, haben diese semantischen Sachverhalte ordentlich dargestellt mit so Definitionsboxen und so weiter. Und wie man unten rechts sieht, betten wir auch Videos ein. Dieses Wikibook-Projekt gehört seit einiger Zeit zu Serlo. Das ist eine andere Lernplattform für Gymnasiasten. Und auch da wird multimedial gearbeitet. Und wie man sieht, geht es hier nicht nur um die Inhalte der Lehre, sondern auch darum, diese Lehre frei verfügbar zu machen und die Organisationsprozesse transparent und demokratisch zu halten. Funktioniert das Ganze? Da geben zunächst mal die Nutzerzahlen recht. Also hier 800.000 Nutzer für Serlo und 110.000 bei Mathe für Nichtfreaks. Und auch das Buch wurde inzwischen bis zu 10.000 Mal heruntergeladen. Das Projekt Serlo an sich ging ursprünglich in München los, hat sich aber in den letzten Jahren über Deutschland verbreitet. Wir sind jetzt also die Nutzergruppe in Dresden, aber auch in Berlin und Münster findet man inzwischen Standorte.
Genau. Genau, warum wir das Wikibook ausgedruckt haben, kann man sich vielleicht vorstellen. Wir wollen eine Alternative zu konventionellen, teilweise sehr teuren Lehrmaterial schaffen. Das Buch ist jetzt auch in der Bibliothek der LMU München zu finden. Die Frage ist nur, warum haben wir dafür jetzt 2 Jahre gebraucht? Haut man nicht einfach die Wiki-Artikel durch Pandoc und schon hat man ein Buch? Naja, ganz so einfach ist das nicht. Zum einen haben wir sehr viel semantisches Markup, worauf wir auch sehr stolz sind. Allerdings können wir deswegen nicht einfach Konvertierungstool wie Pandoc verwenden, weil es für jedes Target anders aussehen kann. Also zum Beispiel in PDF wollen wir Definitionen oder auch Medien anders darstellen als im HTML beispielsweise. Zum anderen haben wir auch noch weitere Dependencies, nicht nur die Artikelinhalte. Hier sieht man diesen roten Punkt in der Mitte. Das ist das eigentliche Buch und alle anderen Punkte sind die Dependencies. Dieses grüne dort zum Beispiel sind sämtliche Mediendateien, also hauptsächlich Videos und Bilder. Dieses gelbe dort oben in der Ecke sind Teile aus Artikeln, die in anderen Artikeln wiederverwendet werden. Und in diesem Kreis sieht man Teile von sieht man die Artikel, wie sie erst im Quelltext vorliegen, anschließend konvertiert werden in ein Zwischenformat, anschließend exportiert werden und dann zum Buch zusammengeführt werden. Das ganze System ist ein Bildsystem, also auf Make basiert, welches verschiedene Rust-Tools aufruft. Momentan sieht das im Groben so aus. Wir haben unsere Wiki-Plattform, ein Parser erzeugt eine Zwischenrepräsentation und aus dieser exportieren wir dann die tatsächlichen Artikel. Und wir haben auch noch einen Linter, der unseren Autoren automatisch Hinweise geben kann. Dank Rust können wir das Ganze dann auch im Browser laufen lassen. Zukünftig wollen wir allerdings diese beiden Plattformen ein bisschen besser vereinen und dann natürlich auch das Aufwand sparen. Deswegen ist das Ziel, die Seiten von Mathe für Nicht-Freaks in eine Zwischenrepräsentation zu überführen, die mit Serlo kompatibel ist, auf deren Basis wir dann den Linter implementieren können und weitere Export-Targets hinzufügen können, zum Beispiel E-Books wären sehr schön, dass wir nicht so viel Totholz am Ende haben. Genau, wenn ihr mit uns in Kontakt kommen wollt oder irgendwelche Anregungen habt, wir sind auch immer sehr interessiert an Vorschlägen für die Weiterentwicklung der Plattform, auch in technischer Hinsicht, das für uns vor allem. Es gibt hier die E-Mail-Adresse von Serlo Allgemein, wenn ihr euch gerade für dieses Exportprojekt interessiert oder irgendwas in der Nähe von Dresden seid und an Serlo interessiert seid, könnt ihr uns kontaktieren. Ansonsten gerne auch hier auf dem Kongress. Man findet uns momentan sehr häufig an der AGDSN Assembly oder ruft uns einfach an. Vielen Dank.
Danke. Thank you. Next up is OpenAge. And we already have the slides on the screen, so we can just go ahead.
Hi, everyone. We're a small part of the OpenAge development team. We're doing a free re-implementation of Age of Empires 2. I'm Jonas.
And I'm Michael. So what we are doing, we have been developing a free engine clone for Age of Empires 2, the Conqueror's expansion. We started in 2013, and since then, yeah, we have been doing it. Our game requires the original game assets, so you have to like own a copy of the original game, but we have been writing a completely new engine with unlimited possibilities for modding and so on. The original game engine is quite limited, starting with the fact that it only runs on Windows. As a short overview of the technology which we are using, the engine core is written in C++, but there is an extensive interface to call most of the engine features from Python 3. We are using Cython as glue and CMake, OpenGL, Vulkan isn't even mentioned here, SDL, Qt. And we have our own data description language, Neon, but more on that later. So this is what it's currently looking like. And in the last year, we have had three main advancements. VTEC wrote a new renderer. Then we've got a new world simulation engine, which is completely event-driven, which was done by Tomato. And we have a new modding API, which was designed by Heinesen. All of those advancements are mostly in the background, so there is little stuff which is actually visible, which has changed in the last year, but now we are ready to integrate everything together and basically finish the game.
So the new central component of the engine is entity component based. And this is the game entity which has abilities. Abilities are now in green. And boni are things like the unit is standing on a hill and therefore has more attack damage, and the abilities are permanent things an entity can do, for example, exist, move, die, attack, whatever. In practice, in our own description language, this, in a simplified way, is a villager that just exists with 25 HP and can move and die. The definitions of move, die, attack are not here now. But with that way, it's possible that any entity can do everything. And so trees, for example, can train new units, or animals can convert villagers, or relics can even start to chop wood, if you like. So this API overview here is the whole thing that is able to simulate Age of Empires 2. The green boxes are, again, all the abilities. We have new things like actual inventory management, so the monk transporting a relic is implemented properly and not a new unit that is a combination of the relic and the monk, for example. And our system supports nonlinear attack trees, so you can have arbitrary conditions chained together for advancements in discoveries for your technologies, and this is implemented the following way. So a technology is again just an entity, and the technology has the most important parameter, the updates, all at the bottom, which is a set of patches. Patches are a special feature of our Neon language that allow to change values on the fly in the database. So in this case, the update is on line 9, which is the more HP patch that updates villager live by adding 15 new health points. So whenever this technology is activated, then the database is updated. With the same trick, we can do things like attack and defense, so that, for example, ranged attacks and ranged armor are matched up and produce the correct amount of damage. And we can do very complicated things, like transforming the trebuchet into packed and unpacked. And this whole thing is fed into the event engine, as I said, which basically is a history of everything in the game, in past and the future. And what the engine, what the client only does is play back that view. So it's just a snapshot. So next is funny new things like data conversions. And that was it already. Join us and help us develop a cool thing. Thanks.
Thank you. Next up is crypto payments in hyperinflation countries and beyond.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here. My name is Felix. I'm from the Dash Embassy Thailand. And for the last couple of months, we were very busy basically trying to bring cryptocurrencies from a high-level talk to street-level reality. And it's really a challenge, and I want to share some experiences with you, also experiences the other teams had on the example of Dash. So cryptocurrencies basically have been the most famous use case since we talk about blockchain, since we talk about Bitcoin. But still, almost 10 years later, nobody basically sees any option to pay with cryptocurrencies in the real world. And it's really a challenge to do that, right? You were always talking about the freedom of banking system. At the same time, so many cryptocurrencies are there at the moment, and I just read a new study saying more than 60% of all these tokens are basically cryptocurrencies compared to any other utility token or something. So for the example of Dash, you can see quite a big increase of acceptances worldwide. So we started with 500 this year and up to 4,500. If you look at Bitcoin numbers and all other currencies, it's not that much higher, actually. Or even worse, it's very hard to get good statistics because there are some maps you can register your company if you accept Bitcoins or whatever other currency, but it's not really that you can go anywhere and get a proper number of how many cryptocurrencies acceptances are in the world. So for Dash, especially Venezuela turned out to be use case number one. If you look at it, it makes total sense. Venezuela has an inflation rate of 1.4% for this year. So people are really struggling. If you go in the morning, buy some eggs, you need some money. If you go in the evening, you need quite much more money. So Dash managed to get really a growing and healthy ecosystem in Venezuela. So that we can basically say, if you have a hyperinflation country, cryptocurrency is a fabulous use case, right? And there's not only Venezuela, we have Turkey, we have some countries in Africa. There's more and more countries coming up where this totally makes sense. But of course, for me, I mean, from a business perspective, it would be very sad to say we focus only on the hyperinflation countries. We want to go beyond that, right? Of course, you have to have everything in place. You have to have the regulators, you have to have taxes, you have to pay your taxes, you have to do everything. And if you talk to merchants, and that's especially the point, you will find out they have many questions. And the most important thing, they don't really care for cryptocurrencies. What they care for is a simple solution which fits into their business process, and they don't want to have any investment, right? For additional software, for additional hardware, for additional stuff training. So that's why we go to the merchants, we try to really understand what they want and how we can help them setting up a system and afterwards also giving support to them and answering questions, right? Because if you start with crypto payments and you really go to the street level, there will be more and more things and questions popping up from taxes to regulations, to how to integrate it into POS systems. So there's many things and it's ongoing questions, right? One other thing is we started with the low-hanging fruits for us in Thailand, going to every single Bitcoin shop there, right, who claims to accept Bitcoin and has a sticker on the door. Just realizing everybody just forgot it, right? So we went into these stores and people look at us and say, B what? So they don't even know what Bitcoin was, right? Because the stuff in there, they forgot it already a long time. So that's why I say it's really important to give them ongoing support and to help them basically solve a problem. And the biggest problem they have is they want to make business, right? This is what they really care for. They want to have, they want to sell their products. They want to get more customers. And at the end of the day, they want to get happy customers because happy customers will come back in their stores, right? So that's why our approach for the example of Thailand and also Venezuela is going a bit in that direction is growing healthy ecosystems. That means you have to have the whole set of things together. One thing is the exchanges. You have to get your money back. You have to manage a cash flow as a merchant, right? So basically you have to choose, do I want to keep my cryptocurrency for speculative reasons? Or will I sell it instantly when I get it, right? You have to have the payment providers. You have to have, of course, you have to pay your taxes at the end of the day. This is the one side, and the other side is the customers coming in, right? You need a community coming and paying with that stuff. Only hodling is really not paying with it, right? So you need people who come in the stores, help, and all that. So at the end of the day, it all boils down to sustainable ecosystems. Thank you. I'm here for questions.
Thank you. Next up is BulkCon.
Good morning. I'm Jelena from BulkCon Orga team. I'm here to present our conference, small hacking event that's happening in Serbia, Novi Sad. So for the next year, it will be seventh time that we organize this event. It's BulkCon Computer Congress. The dates are already set up, so it will be second week in September, 13, 14, 15 September. Novi Sad, so remember it. What exactly is BulkCon? We got an idea 10 years ago on CCC to start organizing small conference in Serbia because there's a lot of students in Novi Sad. There's a big technical university and we wanted to share with them this experience that we have here. And we want to introduce the young people from that Balkan region with the hacking culture. So that's the reason why we started organizing this, and now it starts to be an annual event. We are doing it that we are saying just for fun, because we have a lot of fun there. So we are inviting you to join us next year if you weren't there yet. So this is the important dates. The place is Novi Sad, Serbia. And the CFP will be open from February somewhere, and the complete list of speakers will be somewhere end of July. And yes, we also have the CTF we are organizing every year. So if you are not able to come, you can also join playing the CTFs and have fun with us. And who was this year's with us? We got some also famous speakers. Travis Goodspeed was a couple of times on BulkCon. Virus from US. Mitch Altman was there also with Soldiering Mo. Then Rob from US. So there is a long list. So if you're interested in what we are doing previous years, you can also check our website. And there is a complete archive with the videos that you can watch, so that you know how it looks like. And what's important, yes, we have there a lot of fun. We have let's say that's tradition, on second day in the evening, we have rakia tasting or rakia leaks. So if you don't know what's rakia and want to try different sorts of rakia, you're welcome to come. Also, if you want to try here rakia on our BulkCon assembly, you can come and try it, just in advance to be prepared what you can expect. So I'm just informing you. So Balkan, why Novi Sad? It's our hometown, so we started organizing there. But Novi Sad is on the list of Lonely Planet, I think somewhere in the top 10 to visit next year. So it's a nice city, cheap. Food is very good, incredible. You can ask other people who already visit us how it's food and how it's cheap accommodation. And the travel, it's very easy to come because it's only 1 hour from Belgrade Airport, so it's very easy, or 3 hours from Budapest, so you can choose it. If you have questions, what we are doing and why we are doing that, you can also send us an email. We are responding very quickly, and you can also visit our website, or you can track it us on the Twitter. Also here on Balkan Assembly, here near in the Chaos West Hall, you can find us, grab some stickers. We have some cool stickers also this year, and also some flyers. So you can come, or you can just talk to see what we have. Also what we have, we try to bring there also hacking community, to build a community. We also have hacking space area, so if you are from some hacker spaces, you can organizely come, got also some assembly. So it will be nice to join us, because we also have some blinking stuff, and we want to bring it more and more to make it more shiny. So remember, next September, 13, 14, 15, please come join us to have a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Now next up is exploiting WPS PBC on Windows 10.
All right, hi guys. My name is George. I'm the author of Wi-Fi Fisher. Well, Wi-Fi Fisher is an open source rogue access point framework. So today we're going to talk about exploiting WPS PBC on Windows 10. This is a Wi-Fi association attack. How many of you know the Karma attack? Please raise your hands. Okay, I see some hands. So Karma is a very popular association technique. What it basically does is getting man in the middle for the attacker. But there are others. In this talk, we're going to talk about one attack by exploiting WPS PBC that actually achieves the same result, man in the middle over Wi-Fi. So WPS PBC, I guess most of you already know it. It's a feature that allows you to associate a device with an access point very easily, just by pushing a button on the access point side and then another button on the device side. It doesn't matter the order, right? You can push the device first, and then you can push the button on the access point later. But you need to do that within 120 seconds. So there are no other authentication mechanisms in place. This is how WPS PBC works. So you see, this is the station. It could be a laptop. It could be a mobile device. You push a virtual button there. Then within 120 seconds, you need to push the button on the access point. And these two, the association happens, and the station is now connected to the access point. What's the problem here? The problem is that someone can push the button faster than the operator of the access point, right? So it will achieve a man-in-the-middle position because the station will connect to the rogue access point instead. So this is the way to achieve a man-in-the-middle attack over WPS PBC. In order for this to happen, of course, the victim needs to push the virtual button on his station. The thing is that even if you don't use WPS PBC actively, you are still vulnerable on Windows 10. And let's see why this happens. The problem with Windows 10 is that if you select a WPS network, then you automatically, the Windows 10 pushes the WPS PBC virtual button for you. Even if you are not actively using it, you are eventually. So this is actually a usability over security feature that Microsoft introduced for another usability over security feature, which is WPS PBC. How can we exploit this? First, I will show four steps, right? So the first step is that, let's say that the victim is connected to a WPA, WPA2 network. We do nothing here. Everything, the victim is happy. Of course, the victim uses a Windows 10 laptop. So what we're going to do first is disconnect the victim from the network. We can do that via common methods. We can craft the authentication frames, for example. We can leverage jamming techniques. There are many ways to do that. So we want to disconnect the victim from the network that is currently connected to. As soon as we do that, the victim, we expect the victim to manually click on the network to reestablish the lost connection. But at the same time, we advertise the same network, same SSID, with a random password, if it's a WPA2 password. But this time, we also offer WPS PBC capabilities. So can you guess what will happen? The victim will click on the network, and the virtual WPS button will get pushed from his side. So what we need to do now? We simply press the button from our side as well, and the victim will eventually connect to our rogue access point. The victim will probably have the impression of the auto-connect feature. Do you know the auto-connect feature? The feature where you go back to work and you see that your device is connected automatically to the network, even if you had connected to it like a week ago. This is the auto-connect feature. So that it will give the impression to the victim that it auto-connected because of this feature. So what is funny about this is that the network can be closed. It will have the same SSID. It will be WPA2 protected. You will just click on the network that you want to connect, but still, you will connect to a different one. And again, the problem here is that Microsoft has, let's say, tied clicking on a network with pushing the WPS PBC button on the client side. This hasn't been disclosed before. It's the first time that I'm disclosing this. And you can do this attack by using the latest version of Wi-Fi Fisher. We're going to push an update soon, so you will be able to do this attack for your penetration testing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, next up is Human Connection. Free and open source social network for active citizenship.
Okay, hello everyone. My name is Robert. I'm one of the developers of Human Connection, which is a free and open source social network for active citizenship. Now, I want to highlight a problem. Let's say you are a user of a social network, for example, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and you use the social network as a primary source of information. Then you are not in control of your newsfeed anymore. Why? Facebook, YouTube are private companies. The source code is closed source, and the algorithm determines what information you will see, what content you see, if they run ads, also what ads you see. And that's why I demand that social networks should be free and open source software. The definition of free software, the users control the program. Non-free software is if the program controls the user. That is the case for Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Therefore, we are developing a free and open source social network, which is funded by donations. And we are almost sustainable. We need 30K per month for a team of 10 people. And I'm showing you this chart because I want to show that this works. There's a market, let's say, for donation-funded software. Also, I want to highlight that free software is very important that free software is funded by donations. Why? Facebook and YouTube have their advertising customers, and they will probably implement features that are not in the interest of the users, right? Free software is community driven, and since the users control the program, features should always be in line with the interests of the user. So Facebook will show you ads, that's definitely not in your interest. Facebook will collect your data, that's also not in your interest. Whereas free software will not do that. Human Connection is free and open source software. We will not show you any ads, and also we are not collecting your data. Or if you do, we do it on a certain purpose, and you can see our open source code on GitHub and see how it works. So We are currently in a technology transition. You can check out our current staging environment. It's called Nitro. You can see a link on the right side. You can also see the login credentials on the right side. You can go there right now and try it out. Since we are in a technology transition, I will tell you what we are using. For this version, we are using Vue.js in the front end, and we are using Node.js on the back end side. Both parties communicate through GraphQL as an interface. And on the back end side, we're using Neo4j as the primary database. The former version, we have 4,000 users, and 2,300 of them are active donators. Yes, and probably you have heard about similar initiatives like that. You probably know Mastodon, you probably know Diaspora, and there are many more. And we want to collaborate with these. There's good news. There's a W3C standard, which is called ActivityPub. It's like a language how different social networks can communicate with each other. That is, they can exchange content. And from the user perspective, it doesn't really matter which social network you should join. Well, that's the dream. And we are not implementing it yet, but we are intended to do so. And we have biweekly meetings with other social networks, including Communactor, WeChange, and even Nextcloud. They all are interested in implementing ActivityPub, and we're trying to learn, get familiar with it, and eventually implement it. If you want, you can join us. Here's the chat for our, let's say, we call it the Open Apps ecosystem, the network of the networks. And we are also having a weekly meeting for the open source community. That's the link on the right side. We have weekly meetings, and we try our best to onboard open source contributors. We do pair programmings. We do video conferences. Feel free to join us. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is iOS privacy.
Hi. So quickly, a few words about me, who I am. I am both the Apple guy at Surrogate, a security company, but I'm also an activist and politician in things like refugees and say, trying to save a forest for a mean environment, for a mean energy company. So I built a sample app called My Privacy, where I'm going into, it's a very simple simple app where I'm showing you different stuff that are important on iOS and that developers should do and that users should also look at. And it's things like the contacts API, the calendar API, location, and yada, 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 and surprisingly enough, Siri. I was surprised the first time that I was researching on this because Siri turns out to be something that was appearing by default for every app. So it's default. It's opt-out. The app is in settings Siri, but in the Siri in search is not always in the settings app. It's a little bit confusing. And it says, as you can see over there on the screenshot, it says that it may learn and make some decisions based on how you use the app. I was wondering what it actually means. That's basically what they mean is a shortcut suggestions, which is a good thing, but at the same time also kind of a pain in the ass as a user. The most of the stuff, actually all the stuff of Siri is on device, so it's good to know. The speak to text now is not on device, so that's something you should know. The gist of all the stuff on iOS in terms of privacy is that it all goes through a set of permissions you get. For the photos, it's kind of the same as for the events or the contacts. It's a lot of time just an enum which gives you if it's authorized, denied, or if it's not yet asked. If it's restricted, you're out of luck because it's mean it's either parental settings or something else in an enterprise. The app will crash, luckily, if you haven't done this, which is adding what's called a description, usage description. This is something which is going to be shown to the user. This is just to visualize your photos on a map. And it's also going to be checked by Apple. It should be checked, at least, in the review process, that you are telling to your users what you are actually doing with it. So please tell the users what you are actually doing with it, and don't lie on your users. So there's a bunch of those which are basically in your info pill list. They all start with privacy, and you have to explain whatever you're going to do with calendars or Bluetooth or whatever. You can also ask again, that's something good to know, by calling this URL, which is basically the open settings URL string. It's not going to pop up the permission settings anymore, but it's going to be the user is going to be able to land up in this page, which is basically in the privacy over there. So you have to always check the authorization status, obviously, and there are ways that you can retrieve data from, for example, from a metadata if you get, for example, the location over there. So this is going way too fast. Please use the pickers. That's very important, because if you don't use the pickers, then the people will have to give access to the full thing. Also, if you want to be a good developer, please only pick up a set of data and don't take everything else, because that's what a bad developer would do, and that's take a lot of information. That's what an ugly developer would do, take all the information for all the server, upload it on the thing. So please, don't be that guy. Have a good karma, and just also, you don't need to ask the permissions. A lot of time you can use against the picker. There's something else on the contacts API as well, where you can only have one of the pickers. Also, the contacts have a location, even if they don't have a latitude and longitude, because if they have a postal address, you can retrieve this. So with like geocoding, so this is something to know. The other thing that I wanted you to know is that the location API is interesting, because MapKit already knows where I am, even though I didn't allow him to tell him. You might think it's because of the region settings, but it's not. It's most probably the IP address. I would prefer if they actually ask me before they centralize this map on where I am. On the location API, when you request the authorization, you have to use when in user always. Please do not directly ask the full Monty. Ask first this, and then you would be able to avoid this guy, because the second time you will ask, you will have only this. And that's basically, I'm running out of time. There is something on the calendars which is taking all the thing. Four, if you want to know more three, about this, just get two, in touch with me. One. I will be happy to show you this.
Thank you for this animated slideshow. Nice. All right, next up is Tree Area Network.
Hello, my name is Ingo. I wanted to share an experiment with you I did earlier this year. It's called Tan Tree Area Network. And when I put up this presentation, I basically thought, well, it's actually a bunch of holiday images I share with you. But before I do that, what is capacitive coupling? That is a technique to transmit or transfer information through capacitive coupling, which means you have information, you go into something, you encode it, you amplify that, you send it into a biological conductor, like a human being. Human being is a very good conductor, like a capacitor. It has very low resistance internally, and a skin which is high resistance. So it does capacitive couple to another part of the body or another body. Then you can take this information out and decode it and get the information back. That works with humans, it also works with plants. So. What I did at the DynaCon Digital Naturalist Conference in 2018 in Phuket in Thailand is I wanted to try out capacitive coupling devices I built for e-textiles in the first case, but the experiment was to use it on trees and, if possible, to use it to send information from one tree to another and then use the jungle as a network and send one bit of information from one side of the jungle to the other side of the jungle. So I wanted to try it out if it works at all. That was the first experiment. I just stuck these capacitive plates on some plants, and you see my face, it didn't really work. I don't know if you see the oscilloscope, it's picked up very, very low signals. That was the second attempt. I wrapped around the capacitive, like the electrode around the tree, and it worked much better. You see that in the signal. Picked up very good signal, so I can decode information again. What could I do? I could transmit data for 5.4 meters from one tree to the bottom of the tree. That is how the schematics looks like. The transmitter is a simple resonant circuit transmitting a carry wave of 300 kilohertz. Receiver is basic radio stuff, amplifying and filtering, basically. That is how it looks on a tree. Left is the transmitter with a sensor. It transmits the data over the tree, picked up by another part of the tree on the right side, and sent to a computer. The data is sent over serial to a computer to read out. That's some details. What the implementation can do. A simple on-off keying. The next step was the costume TAN. Tree area network for tree huggers. So how do we pick up information from trees? We can hug the tree. It does capacitive couple from the tree to the human body. We can then get the data out of the human body. And that's what we did. We decoded information we don't understand what it says. So the scientist is reading the signal from the probe, from the human probe, getting the data from the tree. Right. So if you want to try that out yourself, everything is up on GitHub and on my webpage. Try it out. Have fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is GNU Linux Improved.
Yeah, hello. My name is Zem, or Hans. And as you have seen two talks ago, it is very hard to make the security right in iOS. And Linux is not the problem here because all the features aren't there exactly. So, and I think that is wrong. And 2018 OS should be able to restrict applications from modifying each other's data and restrict applications from spying the user's habits. So, yeah, situation is that all applications have the same permissions. USB drivers are fetched automatically. Xorg is a whole security nightmare. And processes can read any data in home user. And also there are interfaces that doesn't need to be exposed to each application you are running. So, yeah, there are a few developments. We always have the ability to make Unix POSIX users groups. We have AppArmor, we have SE Linux, we have KVM, we have namespaces, we have USB guard, Docker, Xpra. There are some Linux distribution projects like Cubes OS or Subgraph OS, which are trying to improve the security as well. So I have still some questions left. For example, do you remember that there is a policy in Debian that there has to be a man page for every Unix command on the system? So also, why do we still have XDM? Why do we have still those graphical display managers? So it doesn't make sense to have a graphical display manager if you don't have to switch the display resolution in the display manager. And that's the case with new Wayland and new frame buffers. So the kernel already runs at a reasonable display resolution. So we don't have to do this for a proper login. So Also, there are things in the Linux world. So why do I have to become an expert to get a GNUPG key layout? I mean, this is an application thing, but reasonably, why do I have to be an expert to get an authentication key? So I would like to make a fresh start by creating a small but functional base system that actually boots up without taking resources from /usr, like most likely the FreeBSD things are doing, adding an AppArmor profile, add a package manager that can be used to install apps, create a quick and dirty installer, push the thing on a separate GitLab instance for bug tracking and building. And I would like to discuss those ideas with you. So let us meet at 11:30 today in lecture room M1. And you see, I have a few bugs in my slides. I also have I've created an improved matrix channel, 35C3 Linux improved, where you can meet me. There will be an email address, linuximproved@fnordpol.de, where you can contact me, and you can meet me at the Meta Lab in Vienna if you want to discuss details. And I think that's it.
Thank you. Next up is navigating in Linux kernel security area.
Hello. My name is Alexander Popov. I'm the Linux kernel developer and security researcher, and I want to tell you about navigating in the Linux kernel security area. Linux kernel security is a very complex area. There are various key concepts there. There are vulnerability classes, exploitation techniques, bug detection means, and various defenses. Some of them are in the Linux kernel mainline. Some of them are still out of tree. Some of them are commercial. Some defensive technologies need special hardware to work. And all these items have complex relations between each other. And it would be really great to have some graphical representation to navigate for easier navigation in the documentation. So I created such a map. It is available at the GitHub. It operates the key concepts which I already described. And the connection between nodes represents some kind of relation. This map is about the Linux kernel self-protection. It is not about cutting attack surface. So this is a map. It is very complex. I guess you can't see anything. But I want to show some part of it. So there are those are vulnerability classes, stack depth overflow, uninitialized variables, usage information exposure. They have CWE, common weakness enumeration numbers, for easier search. And there is a PEX memory stack leak feature from JAR Security, which provides some mitigations against those kinds of attacks, against those kinds of vulnerabilities. And there is a stack leak port, which I prepared for the Linux kernel mainline. It is merged into kernel 4.20. And there is a KMSAN debugging mechanism. It is not for protecting you in production, it is for debugging, and we can combine such technologies, enable them, and fuzz the kernel to find the bugs in 0 days. And I really hope you are interested, and I encourage you to experiment with your kernel and read those information sources. There is a really nice list of JAR security features. There is a Linux kernel security documentation in the mainline, which is a really nice document describing the whole picture of Linux kernel security. which tasks do we have, which goals we need to achieve. There is a list of recommended kernel settings from kernel self-protection project, which can, if you enable them, your kernel can be more secure. And there is a mitigation checklist, which shows the current progress in upstreaming jar security features into Linux kernel mainline and to Android open source project then. And it is really not very funny to search in your config file for the hardening options, enabling them, and so on. So let's computers do their job. And I created a script which can check your kernel config file against the hardening recommendations. And you can just run it with your config file, see the recommendations, and if and then go to the map and see where in the documentation you should read about this particular feature. So thanks for your attention. You can catch me here at the Congress. You can write me emails. Linux kernel developers really like plain text emails. And the main point, enjoy the Congress.
Thank you. Now, next up is pass the cookie and pivot to the cloud.
Hello, everybody. My name is Johan. I'm a security engineer and professional penetration tester. And today I want to talk about pass the cookie, which is an attack technique that I've been using for a long time, and I want to kind of share it. It's not really totally novel, but I think we need to talk more about this to protect infrastructure better. So what are cookies? I think we don't have to talk about that much. Everybody knows about cookies. They're used for security, for authentication, and establishing a session between a client and a web server. And it usually is a single key to the kingdom, which means if you steal the cookie, then you get access to the web application. There was a lot of talk about 4 or 5 years ago with FireSheep that was really, really good, right, where we kind of, the entire industry stepped up and we kind of deployed SSL much more widely, which is very, very good, and everybody should use that. But what I want to talk about now is sort of other techniques somebody might deploy or leverage to steal your authentication cookies. So think about it. A cookie might be the single key. Who here uses AWS or Microsoft Azure? A cookie might be the single key to your entire data virtual data center. So if you have like a data center, a building, you imagine, right, the cookie is the key to that building. Or personally, if you have cryptocurrency or finances, right, or Facebook, the cookie might be the authentication token to get an attacker in. So what is pass the cookie? So if you can tell, it's very much similar if you're familiar with pass the hash. Right? It's the same concept. You have the token, you pass it, and you pivot through the environment. So an attacker might be after valuable assets, valuable hosts in your infrastructure, where there might be powerful cookies available. And as I said, I've used this many, many times during adversarial emulation to achieve mission objective. So how can you kind of gather the cookie in the first place? So pass the cookie is sort of a post-exploitation technique, which means the host that we talk about is already compromised. So imagine a phishing attack. There's a beachhead established in the organization and the company, that, and then the adversary starts pivoting through the environment, right? Maybe even compromise the domain controller. So at that point, they have full capabilities within the company. But they still have not pivoted what I call the pivot to the cloud. So now they can go find an administrator of the subscription or the AWS account, compromise that machine, and then they can pass the cookie. They steal the cookie using some of these techniques here, and then they pass the cookie to pivot to the cloud infrastructure. The one thing I want to point out here is process dump, which is sort of a very, very simple tool. But cookies are not just stored in processes of browsers, right, or on the disk from a browser's perspective. Cookies, you can also find them in other applications that do authentication. So somebody might use process dump to kind of dump all the processes in the machine and look for cookies. So yeah, and then how do you pass the cookie? In the past, like 4 or 5 years ago, right, you had to install some extensions and so on. Now it's really simple. You use the developer console. You just go in the console and set the cookie. Or there's even UI. Like Chrome has a nice UI to set the cookie. Yeah, I want to point out cookie crimes, which I just right now I work at a place where we have a lot of Macs. So I had to look for techniques on how to do this on a Mac. And there's great research done. And there's something called cookie crimes that uses headless Chrome to allow you to steal the cookies. So here's a simple example how you might compromise GitHub. Right? You go to the GitHub web page, refresh, there's no cookies, you're not authenticated. There's a single cookie called user session. You paste it in, refresh the page, and you're logged in. And now let's move this to the cloud. This is sort of really what I want to kind of highlight. Is your organization might have, or Google Cloud Compute, for instance, another, like one of the three big cloud infrastructure providers, right? An adversary might have stolen, compromised the administrator, and then they steal a cookie and pivot into the cloud. So sort of a three-step process. Sort of part of my own like work, I started building out this cheat sheet for myself. So I thought I'd share that, which kind of cookies you might be interested in, depending on the client you work with. And always make sure that you have authorization for any of this kind of work, right? That's sort of something I've put it in the very beginning as well. So here you can see a sample of interesting web pages and the cookies that you can steal, or that somebody might steal, an adversary might steal to authenticate and simulate a breach. Talking about detections, right? There's things that we kind of have to do is like monitor for process dumps, monitor for access anomalies, monitor for unusual activity on websites. And then I want to move forward and talk about mitigations also, right? Deleting cookies on the machine regularly is very important. Delete the session cookies, right? If you are, and this is one thing I want to highlight, right? If you are not the only administrator on your machine, it is not your machine. Anything on it belongs to everybody else or any other administrator on the machine also. Right? That is very, very important, especially if you work in a company. Never use your company laptop to perform work. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is more on drugs.
Hello. The full title of the talk is War on Drugs, Undoing 50 Years of Fake News and Propaganda. You need to decide for yourself, what do you want to do? What is your core set of values? And me personally, I am pro-choice, freedom, and education. There are many different scientific research. This is about the fat and sugar. The sugar industry blamed fat. You eat fat, you become fat, but this is not true. You need to provide fat to your body because it's a part of a healthy, balanced diet. This is the cigarette advertisement from 50 years ago. Yeah, of course, your doctor smoked Camels. The Marlboro guy who was advertising cigarettes, he died from lung cancer. And this is probably one of the most important quotes, that 50 years ago, then the Nixon presidential election, and basically you cannot make illegal to be against war. So what they did to keep the war in Vietnam going, they criminalized drugs. The war on drugs is a direct consequence of war in Vietnam. They couldn't keep up with the peace movements, so they had to find a way to put them into prison. And then we have a private prison system. The moment you make money from putting people into prison, you are incentivized to keep the system going. And this is basically a vicious circle. It is a complete bullshit. And I encourage you to just think, follow the money. If you do not know what's going on, just follow the money. And all these pervert incentives create a situation when judges are bribed by the prison system to put children into jail. However, now we have a little change in the law because of the internet. Internet allows us to communicate freely. This is the legal map of cannabis in the US. In many states, cannabis is legal or legal for medicinal purposes. It is changing rapidly. The human perception is also changing. In the United Kingdom, the medical cannabis was legalized 1st of November. In Mexico, it is also changing. In South Africa, it is changing. It is pretty much becoming legal. So this is just the cannabis. Okay, this is about the business model of pharmaceutical industry. They get money if you are hooked on their legal drugs, and they don't have incentives to use the drugs that are actually helping people. This is the ketamine that is testing for depression, MDMA for PTSD, psilocybin for people who have terminal diseases and they know they will die, but using a psychedelic such as psilocybin allows them to become more okay with death. Like, okay, I'm dying, but this is only my body, my soul will survive. So it is, they are reducing their anxiety. And this is like a second level research that we already know that psilocybin is effective. So now we are testing which type of music for this type of treatment. So this playlist is amazing, I highly recommend it. Books about DMT. This is a metaphor that we have the telescope to look into the stars. We have the microscope to look into a very, very small object, but we are still looking for the microscope for the brain. So here it is an example of a scientific research of scanning the brain, various connections in the brain. Here is the wiki with a self-medication, psychedelic retreats, and this is probably, if you want to stay connected, psychedelic.community, you can meet with like-minded people, you can learn more, and always do your own research. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you. Now, the next talk is not going to be a talk, but rather an experiment. And one of the rare occasions where we surrender our hardware to someone else. This is the last event in this session, so if you're not comfortable with any of this, you can just leave without missing out on anything. I don't know. I just go away and let them do their work.
Thank you.
right, thanks. So, big round of applause for these guys. And that's the end of our session today. Thank you for being here. Thanks to all the speakers who participated. And a big round of applause for everybody who stood on the stage here. Also, a big round of applause for the translation team who did an awesome job translating the lightning talks.